Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Jack Tanner. I'm with Fairfield and Woods. I'm here on behalf of the Rastler Education Foundation. As soon as she gets back with my cup of water, with me at council table is Sarah Millard. If ever a case involved a violation of the contracts clause, this is the case. The crucial issue in this case is whether the state legislature can pass a statute which only does one thing, which is obviate a provision of a contract the state itself has entered into. In this case, the law in question is actually an amendment to a prior law, which the amendment is not a public and general law. And that's crucial in this analysis. This amendment only does one thing. It's not a public and general law. It only affects one contract in the whole world, and that's a contract to which the state is a party. The text of the amendment is found in the record at page 157. And you can compare, you can look and see the effect of this amendment if you compare the prior case, Rapture Education Foundation 1, which is found at pages 12 to 22 of the record. The holding in that case was that my client, Rapture Education Foundation, had an exclusive contract with the government. The state could not issue these specialized plates to anyone except members of the Rapture Education Foundation, and the state had to pay damages for doing so.
Well, and indeed, the legislature in 2002 passed a statute that said that, right?
Yes, it did, which I think, actually, for purpose of all this, is irrelevant, because that we had a contract. A panel of this court affirmed that contract, found it was a valid contract, and the state was liable for damages without any reference to the statute whatsoever. Statute was not passed until after the contract was signed. But then if you look in the record at pages 118 to 119, you'll find the affidavit of a Department of Motor Vehicle employee that says what the practice of the DMV is. And he says, well, we have this amended statute now, so we issue plates either to Rapture Education Foundation or to this other organization. So between the text of the language and the effect of the language, which is in the record even on cross motions for summary judgment, we can tell what this amendment did, and all it did was get the state out of its exclusivity obligation under the contract. So it's not public and general law, and that's crucial to this analysis, because if you start with if you picture a spectrum between, like all constitutional rights, the contracts clause is not an absolute right. There are times it's violated, there's times it's not. At one end of the spectrum, we've got the constitutional end of the spectrum, and that's, for example, the Horowitz case. In the Horowitz case, back from the 1920s, Mr. Horowitz signed a contract with the United States government to ship some silk by rail. Before the silk could be shipped, an embargo against silk was passed, and therefore the government did not ship the silk. Mr. Horowitz sued for damages and lost, and the opinion specifically says, it's only two pages. The opinion specifically says, as long as the law is public and general, it's basically not a contract clause violation, and that's what an embargo against silk is, a public and general law. In fact, they had this collateral effect on this one contract, doesn't change that analysis. Now, near the other end of the spectrum is the Winstar case, which both sides have heavily relied on. Winstar starts with Horowitz and then goes on. Winstar talks about this public and general law requirement in the contracts clause analysis. And in Winstar, the facts were that Congress, or an executive agency, went to a healthy savings and loan, Winstar. This is during the financial crisis of the mid-80s. You got failing savings and loans all over the country. The FSLIC went to a healthy savings and loan and said, would you take over these failing ones? And as part of the deal, which the government signed, we'll give you this favorable tax treatment. Winstar did. They acquired some failing savings and loans. Thereafter, Congress passed FIREA, the Financial Institution Recovery, Reinvestment, and Enforcement Act, I think. Talk about a public and general use law. It applied to every financial institution in the country. Savings loans, banks, everybody. Nevertheless, when one of the aspects of that law was to do away with its favorable tax treatment that Winstar had relied on, Winstar paid the tax, sued for a refund, lost, went up on appeal, and the Supreme Court said, even though this is in fact a public and general law, so we're still under Horowitz, part of the purpose of this law was to get out of this contract the government now regrets having signed. Therefore, Winstar wins, government loses. What the government is not allowed to do under the contracts clause is enact legislation that gets itself out of a contract.
So let me ask you this question then. The record doesn't contain, as I recall, anything that says that it was the purpose of the General Assembly when it passed the 2009 amendment to get out of this contract.
That's probably correct. I don't recall that in the record either.
So where, how do we get to that phase of Windstar then to say that the purpose is to get out of the contract?
Well, my first point is that we're not even under Windstar because it's not a public and general law. So we don't even get to that point. So if it's not a public and general law, it's unconstitutional because all it does is get out of this contract. But second, again, that's why I suggest you compare the opinion in REF1 with the affidavit of the employee of Denver, of the Department of Motor Vehicles, who says, this is what we do in response to this. So whether or not it was, and I think 2 + 2 = 4, you can say, well, the only thing it does, if you look at the text of it, all it does is take out the word foundation, where it said Raptor Education Foundation, now it says Raptor Education, and then it add another sentence which says, and you can issue to the Raptor Education Foundation, or you can issue to this other entity. So there's no other purpose for this act. If it was intended to do that, it doesn't do anything. It's the only thing it does.
Pardon me, Mr. Taylor.
Yes.
I want to explore the scope of what you're arguing here. Let's assume that the legislature decided that it's a bad thing to have license plates that only a few, a discrete group of people can have. And it passes a statute that says either specialty plates are available to everyone or we're not going to have them. So it's like a Broncos plate or a CU plate. Would that be, under Windstar, would that be constitutional or?
I think that would be a much closer call. I think then you're talking about, is this a fundamental policy shift by the state of Colorado? In fact, in the legislative history regarding the original enactment, there's a legislature that said, we've got more than 70 specialized plates. I think we're now in the bumper sticker business. And I think that's a legitimate public policy discussion. Should Colorado, the state of Colorado, be in the bumper sticker business? If that happened, I think you would have to go look at the legislative history and say, why is it? Because the way these statutes are written, as I understand it, there are some organizations that don't have a contract the way my client has a contract. Some organizations, they just passed a statute. So it might be a different analysis if their only rights in the first place were statutory and that was amended. So I can't go too far out on a limb to answer your question. I agree that would be a closer question. That looks more like Windstar. And in Windstar, what the majority opinion said was, at least part of the reason was to get around these ill-advised contracts.
Right.
That's their term, ill-advised contracts. And here, again, without, if that's not the point of this amendment, I don't know what it does, because that's the only thing it does. So then just very briefly, so it's not a public and general act, so we don't even get to Windstar. And if we do get to Windstar, if we decide it is a public and general act, the question then becomes, is the state involved in making performance of the state impossible? And this is the question Horowitz uses, the language not fused. The two rules of government are not fused because the silk embargo was such a big thing, whereas shipping this one load of silk by rail from Washington to D.C. to New York was not a big thing. So that was Horowitz. Whereas in Windstar, the court said, well, even though this is a public and general act, because part of the motivation was here, it's still unconstitutional. The way this came up in Windstar was procedurally different because Windstar had actually paid a tax and was suing for a refund. Here, procedurally, we're on cross motions for summary judgment, and what we've got is a defense of impossibility, which is the DMV is saying it's impossible for us to comply with the contract because the law has been changed. So this is when you look at this impossibility analysis. There's four factors, all of which have to be met. The third of which is the party claiming impossibility played no role in the rendering of the situation as impossible. And here you can't say that. Clearly the state of Colorado played a role in making it impossible because the state of Colorado changed the statute. Again, to put a little of this in tech, give you a little texture for this, the case I cited in my supplemental authority, the Keystone Bituminous Coal case, I mean, that was a case where Pennsylvania passed a statute which prohibited coal companies from taking out more than half the subsurface coal, basically. And the reason they did that is they said there's evidence that 14,000 buildings were going to collapse if the coal companies took all the coal out. this had a collateral effect on contracts because these coal companies had contracts with the surface owners that said the surface owners waived any claim for subsidence damages based on the coal being removed. So that's how the contracts clause argument came up. And the court really focused on, hey, this is an act that affects the whole state, 14,000 structures at issue. It relied heavily on the Blaisdell case, which was a depression era case that was a where the state of Minnesota had put a moratorium on foreclosures during the depression. And yet in both those cases, the courts held it's a general public policy of the state. Contracts with the state are not affected. Both those cases were considered close cases. They were both 5-4 decisions. So those are close cases when it's clearly a general and public law and doesn't affect contracts to which the state is a party. And both Blaisdell and Keystone Bituminous were 5-4. Those were close cases. This is not a close case. We are way past Windstar because this is not a general law. This is not a public and general law. I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless there are questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Larson, and I'm here today representing the Colorado Department of Revenue. Because of time limitations and with the permission of the court, I'm going to refer to my client as the department. I will refer to Rocky Raptor Education Foundation as REF, and I'll refer to the Rocky Mountain Raptor Program as Rocky Mountain. Hopefully that'll speed things along. Just by way of background, the court is probably aware, but the department is responsible for classifying, taxing, and licensing motor vehicles, and this necessarily includes the regulation of all matters pertaining to license plates. Several group special license plates were authorized by rule or letter agreement around the time that this plate was authorized. The plate in question, as the court is aware, is the one that says respects wildlife and has a symbol of a raptor on it. In 2002, the General Assembly enacted a statute, which is 423.117.5, and other related statutes, which statutorily recognized certain group plates created by letter agreement, one of which was Raptor. The statutes at that time began, if you will, to set up a structure whereby all plates, and especially group plates, would be regulated by the department through statute and rule. In 2005, the statute 423.117.5 became 423.2081B, which is the statute that we're concerned with here today. The department, through the Division of Motor Vehicles, also regulates license plates through the promulgation of rules. The primary rule that affects group plates is Rule 16 under the division's rules. Colorado statutes, the bottom line is that regulations pertaining to license plates have been adopted, enacted, amended, and changed significantly since the enactment of these statutes. It's just a different world than it was when this letter agreement was entered into. Today, group plates cannot be authorized by letter agreement. Any newly proposed plate also has to have a legislative sponsor, and there has to be an actual statute enacted for that plate. All the plates that are currently enacted by statute are set out in Title 42, beginning roughly at Section 423.213.
Carson, you're not arguing, are you, that this contract was superseded in any way by the statute?
What I'm arguing is that the department has statutory authority to regulate plates, and that the time this agreement was entered into, the laws have changed. And ultimately, we start out with statutes that, in effect, had the effect of modifying this letter agreement, and that began in 2002 and continued on, ultimately culminating in the amendment.
What provision?
It's not a provision in the contract. It gets to the authority of the department to regulate and license and tax motor vehicles.
And already acknowledged that there's a change in how these are treated, and a change in, based on this 2009 amendment, is to allow another group to use this plate, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so isn't the issue whether that's a violation of the contracts clause, regardless of whether the department has plenary authority to regulate license plates?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that this case doesn't involve a contract clause violation. As the trial court found, REF did not plead a contracts clause or constitutional violation in their complaint. The amendment to the law, it went into effect in July of 2009.
Maybe not in the complaint, but it was certainly fully briefed in the summary judgment motions, was it not?
I will disagree, Your Honor. The issue that the department filed their motion on had to do with strict contracts law, and specifically the impossibility defense as it's developed through Windstar. The first time that we ever heard about a contracts clause violation was in REF's response to the department's motion. And at that point, there just isn't as complete a record. The court recognized that the claim did not come up properly, and the court chose not to address that claim.
The authority that provides that it must be raised in the complaint as opposed to briefing in the cross motions for summary judgment, because the court didn't cite any authority, and I'm not sure that you did in your answer brief as well.
That's a good question. Actually, there is authority that I found that allows the court to raise the issue of the constitutionality of a statute sua sponte. And I guess the best way I can explain it is that if, in this case, the trial court had decided it needed to get to the constitutional issue, it could have done so. The court chose not to do that. The court, the general rule is you don't raise the constitutional issue unless the parties do, but you can do it if you have to do it to get to your remedy. In this case, the court found that there was an impossibility defense under strict contract law and chose not to go there.
Just because the court chooses not to bring it up doesn't mean that the parties haven't done so procedurally. That's what I'm trying to understand, is that what requirement is there that it has to be raised in the complaint as opposed to bringing it up in some other fashion?
Well, Your Honor, I can cite two cases that stand for the proposition, the general rule that it's improper for a court to address the constitutionality of a statute unless the issue has been raised explicitly by the parties. And that would be Howell v. Woodland School District, 596 Pacific 2nd, 56, and In Re Foreclosure of Paving Assessments, 95 Pacific 2nd, 806.
How would that apply when you have the actual briefing raising the issue? You know, those cases don't say that to bring a contracts clause violation claim, you have to assert it in the complaint, do they?
Well, that's the basic holding of those, is that it ought to be brought up in a complaint.
And it doesn't use that language. Just says raised by the parties.
Explicitly by the parties.
Wasn't it raised explicitly by Raptor?
It was late in the game. And I guess the best way to get to this, Your Honor, is to point out that the statute was amended in July. The first thing that REF did was go to Denver District Court and try to resurrect the 2001 case by filing a motion to hold the department in contempt for following the statute. That case spent about 9 months in Denver District Court, and ultimately the judge dismissed it, or actually Mr. Tanner raised a motion to dismiss without prejudice, because the court told counsel that he could not hold the state in contempt for following a statute. Then this case was filed, and we get a contract claim and an injunction claim. 2 months before trial was the first time that they raised the constitutionality defense. I would argue that this case would be significantly different had the claim been teed up properly. The parties would be different, the pleadings would be different, the argument would be different and the record would be different. Because when you get to the constitutionality claim and you go to the DeWitt case and you look at the elements that perhaps the court would have considered, which the court did not, the trial court, quoting from, or not quoting, but from the DeWitt case, the contract clauses must be read to permit legislative action that promotes the common weal or the general good of the public through contracts previously entered into between individuals who may be affected. A finding that the law impairs a contract does not end the inquiry. Notwithstanding such a finding, a court should uphold a challenge to a statute if it is reasonable and appropriately serves a significant and legitimate public purpose when considered against the severity of the impairment. That record was not developed, and I think it's it ought to be. If the court needs or feels that you need to address the constitutionality of the statute, that part of the record's not there. This statute was enacted by the General Assembly. There's nothing in the record about that. This case came up as a contract claim and an injunction claim.
Well, I understand your argument, and I'm not saying that this necessarily disagrees with the single thing that you've just said, but it's pretty clear that the trial court knew that there were constitutional contract provisions before it, because the same footnote that you cite to begins with, plaintiff does argue that the July 2009 amendments violate the contract provisions of both the Colorado and United States constitutions in the response. Then the court says, as you point out, that it wasn't properly before the court. But nonetheless, it was before the court. The yes. court just said it wasn't properly before the yes. court. Am I right there?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I guess what I'm arguing is that in a case where the court can avoid a constitutional challenge, it should do so. And in this case, the trial court, because the claim was not pled properly and because the court used the impossibility defense under contracts law, the court didn't have to get there.
Let's assume that the court was wrong in using the impossibility defense, that that's not a defense. What's the remedy?
Well, that's the rub. The issue, if the court had found that the impossibility defense was not viable, the court probably would have had to get to the constitutional question, because the court would have essentially been holding that the department breached the contract by following a statute, and that creates a fundamental problem. If REF is entitled to damages, or if they prevail or at the trial level, then essentially the conduct that's being found troublesome is following a statute, because that's what the department did.
If we were to conclude that the possibility is not the remand, or can we simply address
that's good.
Set of new additional facts were needed, and I'm not sure I understand what additional facts or how the record would have been different. Maybe you can help me there.
Well, I think there might have been different defendants, somebody other than the department, perhaps the General Assembly, the sponsor of this bill. I don't know that the record has enough information in it to, the question was brought up in Mr. Tanner's argument about, he argues that it's clear that it was intended to just run afoul of the original letter agreement. And I don't know what that is. That's not in the record. The second Raptor group, the Rocky Mountain, is a nonprofit. They're a viable organization. Presumably, somebody felt they ought to have the plate too. I mean, that's part of a record that might have been developed, Your Honor. Your Honor, we would ask that Your Honors, that the court uphold the trial court's finding, the granting of the motion for summary judgment. basically, the court determined that the impossibility defense was viable, that in this case, it was not within the contemplation of the parties, that there would not be a statutory change, and that the court decided that it did not have to get to the constitutional challenge. And I think that that's a good way to go. And I would ask the court to follow the trial court's granting of the motion for summary judgment. Any further questions from the court before I sit down? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Touching on a few points. First of all, the authority, this issue of whether the DMV had authority to issue a contract without statutory authority was squarely rejected in the first REF case. That's exactly what REF held, is the DMV signs a contract, like any other party, it's bound by the rules of contract law. Which leads to the question of remedy, which is the remedy is we should be able to get some monetary damages, just like was in the order of remand in REF 1. The state breaches a contract, we have to prove our damages, but that's the remedy I'd suggest. Regarding the issue of raising the constitutional question, the Denise case cited in our brief, I think, is squarely on point. Here what happened was our claim is for breach of contract. It's a defense raised by the state that there's been a change in the law. The way Rule 8 is written, there's no requirement to reply to affirmative defenses, and therefore we did not. But as the court noted, there were six briefs filed on this issue. They're cross motions for summary judgment. This was fully briefed before the court. And to that, I have to take a disagreement with Mr. Larson saying he found some cases. Those two cases he cited, I cited. They're in our reply brief. They're on page 11 of our reply brief. Howell and the paving district. And both those cases stand for the proposition that the court Howell says the court should address a constitutional issue that was not raised in the pleadings but has been briefed by the parties. The paving case says the trial court properly considered a constitutional question addressed by both parties but not raised in the pleadings. So in this case, there was procedurally no place for me to raise it. My claim is breach of contract and contempt of court for violating a previously issued permanent injunction. I don't have a claim for unconstitutionality. The statute doesn't matter to my client until it's raised as a defense, and I have no obligation to reply under Rule 8 to affirmative defenses. DeWitt is an interesting case. I was actually, there's a companion case, Becker, and I was counsel for the prevailing party in that case. And DeWitt, again, is a general and public law. The law in DeWitt was that if you are married and you name your spouse as a beneficiary under your life insurance policy or under your will, then you get divorced, you are presumed to have revoked that designation upon your death. That was the law. And so it was clearly a general and public law, because it affected everybody who's married that makes out a will or has a life insurance policy. Secondly, it didn't involve a contract with the state, because the state is not a beneficiary of life insurance policies, and it's not a beneficiary under the will. So again, this is the Horowitz end of the spectrum. So DeWitt is not applicable in this case, except to say, to draw the distinction between a general and public law to which the state, that affects contracts to which the state is not a party, which is at that end. We're at the end where it's a very specific law to which the state is a party. And then briefly, I would just, can't read my writing, so I'm going to skip that point. On the injunction issue, I would just briefly say that this, I think the same constitutional analysis applies. A permanent injunction was issued. The appeal was originally filed, but then it was dismissed. That permanent injunction was left in place. That permanent injunction was issued under the Due Process Clause of the 5th and 14th Amendments. The state should not be allowed to just flout that and say, well, gee, the law has changed, so we can now ignore it. I think, and the cases cited by the state are cases where the party that was subject to the injunction went back to the court to get it modified, and that they were varying degrees of success, and then it went up on appeal, and that's what resulted in those opinions. In this case, the state just ignored the permanent injunction because it decided things had changed. As Mr. Lawson just said, it decided we're in a whole new world, so we can ignore a permanent injunction. That's a serious separation of powers problem. The state legislature can't just ignore an injunction because it changes the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.